You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Rebecca Lindland from Rebecca Drives.
And I'm Sam Abual Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
All right, one of these days, I want to go last. let's just switch it up on a bit. Anyway, let's talk about what we're driving. Rebecca, what have you been in?
So it was funny because when I was looking at this, I realized that I usually exchange my vehicles on Thursdays, and we happen to be recording on Thursdays. And last week we had recorded, I think, on Thursday, and I just swapped out my Kona EV. So normally I'm very behind schedule on my reviews, and instead I'm like almost ahead of schedule right now.
Yeah, we're right on time. Don't worry,
we're right on time. So I went from the Hyundai Kona EV, I went to the Audi Q7, actually. And this is the 2020. So Audi switched over the agency that does the media drive. So media loans. So there was kind of a long lag. So this thing had 8,000 miles on it already. I was scheduled for it a number of months ago. And then I think all the changeover and everything. So it was actually, you know, it's I like getting into a car that has a little life on it, you know, as opposed to something that's brand new. But when I went to kind of get some specs and everything, the 2021 is already up on the Audi site, but I don't think it's really changed all that much. So anyway, it has, it's a 3.0 liter V6, 335 horsepower, 8-speed automatic. And, you know, I had the Q8 a couple of months ago, which I just loved. And while I really liked the Q7, I think it's a great vehicle for a family. It was heavy, if that makes sense. Like,
it felt heavy, you mean?
It felt heavy. It didn't have a lot of dynamic driving inputs to it. I did put it in dynamic mode, with the Audi Select, which is actually really nice and accessible. But gosh, I wanted it to loosen up a little bit. I felt like, you know, it's like, it's the librarian that's like way too buttoned up.
So it's an uptight family car.
Yeah. It's like, I really miss the Q8. But, you know, when I think about cars like this, one of the things I always try and do is not think of my lifestyle with this, but think about who should buy this car. And, you know, one of the things that we're seeing a lot of is families moving out of the city, out of New York City, for better or for worse. But a lot of families are moving up to this, you know, metro New York area, out of the city, and they're actually buying cars for the first time, and, you know, or in a long time, certainly. And I think that a car like the Q7 is great for that. It's 7-passenger. There's plenty of room in there. I like the fact that there's, you know, it's packed full with technology and safety, and you know, has a great style to it. So that's kind of where I went in my head when I was thinking about this vehicle, is that it's you know, it's a car that you can really grow into as a family. And this had the towing package on it, 7,700 pounds of towing that goes with it. So, you know, I think it's a great, great family car for those people, especially that may be moving out of the city, may not have a car for the first time, you know, or in a long time. And lots of safety features on it, you know, the lane correction. It did often tell me that I needed to drive in the center of my lane, which I don't know if that just
Audi's. If you go on the
critiquing my driving.
Yeah, if you go on the settings, you can change, you know, the degree of, you know, prompting and coaching that you get.
Yes, well, I should have done that. I drove it about 300 miles, but you know, the lane departure was actually kind of cool because you can, especially as we've often talked about, when you're in a new vehicle and you're still trying to learn the buttons, knobs, and switches and everything and where everything is. It's not that it's poorly placed. It's just that we literally have stepped into it and we may not know exactly where everything is. I do like the fact that it has lane centering, or, you know, this one time I was on a two-lane road, nobody was coming, but it corrected, you know, it gently brought me back into the center of the lane. And I like that, you know, it does it in a way that's not obtrusive and keeps you safer, frankly, because it is easy to get distracted in today's world. So I there was things that, you know, I really liked about it. The infotainment system worked really well. I love all the Audi electronics and everything. Nice place for my phone. You know, it was super quiet, which I really, really enjoyed. You know, I thought it was a really, really nice vehicle. The only thing that I didn't love about it was the driving dynamics. I just felt like it was really heavy. And again, I went up and down all the different drive select modes that they have. So this one, it starts at 68,000. The one that I had topped at 86,000. So it's not cheap, but gosh, it's pretty.
Well, and it's not supposed to be cheap. It's kind of like the, it drives heavy. It is heavy.
Have you guys driven it? Have you had that experience?
I have not driven the Q7. No, I've I've driven the e-tron, which is even heavier.
Yeah,
but actually doesn't really feel quite. It actually feels a little more nimble because the e-tron's actually a little smaller.
Yes.
Than this. You know, the Q7 is quite large.
It is. I was on the launch of the Audi e-tron. And I definitely didn't have that feeling, especially because we got lost in Dubai and I wasn't
driving. That
sounds
like a story right there. Right. Lost in Dubai. That's your debut album.
I wasn't driving, but my colleague was. But you know, driving.
Who was
through,
it? Tell us.
I'm sorry?
Who was it?
It was Matt Deegan from Kelley Blue Book.
Okay.
Yes. And he's such a sweetheart. I love Matt. But I actually know I know Dubai fairly well, having lived nearby. And so the e-tron definitely didn't have that feeling. I thought that was a really, really fun car to drive. The other funny thing is that going from the Hyundai Kona EV with that instant torque, I really missed that. It was funny to go.
That's interesting, yeah.
Right? Like, it kind of surprised me because I thought, gosh, you know, the Audi is really heavy. I don't know exactly. I'll try and find out exactly how much it weighs. But, you know, 335 horsepower, that's a good amount. I mean, it's certainly not overkill.
Well, that V6, that's the 90-degree V6, right? That's not, it's not that torquey. Like, it's
not.
Yeah. No.
It's absolutely not that torquey.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a twin turbo V6, but it's, you know, it's not as, I mean, it's fairly responsive, but, you know, in a vehicle of that weight, you know, you can feel that it's working to get up, you know, build up a head of steam.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well,
and turbos, like, no matter how fast they are, and Audi and VW, they're very good at making them spool quickly, but there's still that lag off the line. And I do wonder if you were to have a little time between an EV of any kind and this vehicle again, if you'd still sense that sort of almost like sluggishness, or if you, like you say, like, it might be that, you know, that EV torque is really addictive. It's
it
nice.
Really
well, yeah, I'll say this much. You know, I just today, you know, swapped out an Audi S5, which I'll talk about next week, an S5 Sportback. But, you know, it has basically the same engine, but, you know, in a little higher output. It's like 350 horsepower version of the engine.
And a much smaller vehicle, too.
And a much smaller, much lighter vehicle. And it also does not feel like it's going to leap off the line when you're accelerating off the line. You know, it doesn't have that instant responsiveness that you have from an electric motor or a lot of other, you know, some other gasoline motors.
Right.
So, you know, I can imagine, you know, the Q7 is probably 1,000 pounds heavier than that S5. And so I can see where it would definitely feel maybe a little sluggish off, you know, in its responsiveness.
Yeah. It was deliberate. Is what I'll call it.
Deliberate as in it was thinking about its next move.
Well, it required thought. Like, you know, when you drive a vehicle, you look at vehicles sometimes and you think, does it drive bigger or smaller than it is? And yeah. I was always kind of aware that I was in a large vehicle, not just because it has a high driving position, but it did. It weighed a lot. It weighed a lot. It was a lot to, you know, I enjoy driving it. And I actually drove it down into New York City yesterday. And so, you know, it's nimble for its size, but it's not just nimble, period.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's a good car for Manhattan. It's how does it ride on those streets?
It was wonderful. I mean, yeah. I did play, you know, again, I played around with some of the drive mode and put it in comfort, obviously, for all the potholes and everything.
Yeah.
So, something I'm curious about is the infotainment system. You know, I see it's got the same dual screen setup that's in the e-tron. And does the Q7 also have, you know, the haptic feedback where, you know, you have to actually press a little bit and then, you know, it feels like it's clicking like a switch?
Yes, it does. Although I don't believe it worked in Android Auto, because there were definitely times when
the e-tron's the same way. In Android Auto, it's just touch. There's no haptic feedback.
Right,
there.
Which I do like the haptic feedback a lot.
Okay, I was just curious what you thought of that. Yeah, you know, to me, it was... Almost, but not quite, you know, a little bit of a throwback to the bad old days of the BlackBerry Storm. And for anybody that's ever used a Storm, I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh, I think I had one.
It was their first touchscreen phone. It had the clicky screen.
So
oh
you
my
don't
gosh.
You don't like the haptic feedback? Because I think that's one of the things that I miss.
I like the haptic feedback.
It's like you get a positive response, like you have entered a command.
Right.
The thing that the haptic feedback can't replace is being able to operate it
without looking.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I don't mind the haptic feedback. You do have to get used to the fact that you actually do have to press a little bit harder.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a tap on the screen like it is on a typical touchscreen. You actually have to press a little bit. It requires a bit of pressure for it to respond, you know, but then you get that feedback. And you know, I referenced the Storm, but I mean, it's nothing like the Storm. You know, it's a much more refined feeling, and the screen is not actually physically moving like it did in the Storm.
None of those things happen.
Yeah.
You know, the instrument cluster is cool because you can change it, and it's, you know, the 3D, like all that. I think the Audi's done just a great job with the technology, and it's intuitive. I found it to be intuitive. Again, we go from car to car, you have to get used to the buttons and the switches and such. But that was not a barrier at all.
Okay, cool.
So I enjoyed it.
So Sam, you spent some time in the Hyundai Venue?
I did. Spent a week with the Hyundai Venue SEL. So unfortunately not the denim like Rebecca
had. Yes, I love that one.
But you know, this was a white SEL. You know, so this is... in terms of equipment levels, it's comparable, pretty similar to the denim. You know, so it's the higher end version. There's the SE and the SEL, and the denim are the three trim levels. And you know, I like it. You know, this vehicle is effectively, you know, a replacement for the Accent hatchback, which, you know, went away with the latest generation of the Accent. You know, it kind of takes the place in the lineup, although it is more expensive than the Accent. You know, the starting price on the SE is like $18,750. which is, you know, by today's standards is relatively affordable. You know,
yeah.
It's not cheap. You know, and you know, this, it's a little bit smaller than the Kona. You know, it lacks some of the features of the Kona, so it's a little bit smaller, cheaper than the Kona. You know, it's got front wheel drive only, you know, so it's a crossover, but you know, you can't get all wheel drive in it. It's got a beam axle in the rear, you know, like some others, like the Nissan Kicks, you know, very similar kind of idea where it fits in the lineup. Yeah.
The 2021 though is showing that it has snow mode. The Hyundai Venue.
That's, yeah. I mean, and that's,
is that
probably
new for 2021?
I just
pulled it up and I was caught off guard by
might,
that.
It might be new.
It's an optional, available on the SCL and denim trim. Snow mode helps the driver drive more effectively on slippery roads versus snowy or muddy roads. I feel like that might be new.
It could be, because I don't remember seeing that in here anywhere.
I know.
And you know, I mean, that would be is probably a different set of calibrations that you engage for the stability control. So it's probably a little more, you know, tightens up the slip threshold, so it intervenes a little sooner to try and keep you from getting into trouble in slippery conditions. So, you know, that would definitely be a good thing. But even, you know, even as it is, you know, just front wheel drive, you know, it's a great daily driver. You know, the seats are comfortable. It's roomy. You know, even though, you know, it's a little bit smaller than the Kona, you know, the back seat, you know, I was able to, you know, set the driver's seat where I would normally have it. I got in the back seat. I had some clearance for my knees, you know, and I'm 5'11". You know, my head was not touching the ceiling. So, you know, it's comfortable for four adults. You know, if they're fairly slender, but
you're not social distancing.
Yeah. But you know, certainly for four adults, it works. You know, you got 19 cubic feet of cargo space behind the seat. So, you know, it's a really good all around daily driver, you know, not particularly performant, you know, only 121 horsepower, but it's more than adequate. It's plenty of power. It's got plenty of performance because it only weighs 2,700 pounds. Plenty of performance, you know, for accelerating to merge into highway traffic, things like that. Does have a CVT, but Hyundai does a pretty nice job. You know, it doesn't feel too much like a CVT. It's not particularly noisy. It's surprisingly quiet, really, for what it is. Yeah, the plastics are hard in the interior, and most of the interior.
But they look good though, don't they?
They look good. Yeah, nicely textured. You know, no sharp edges, no flash marks that are visible. You know, so it all looks like it's nicely executed. You know, and the SEL that I had, you know, had the optional sunroof, package with the sliding armrest, storage box, and the leather wrapped steering wheel and shift knob, blind spot monitoring with cross traffic alert, which is always a good thing to have, you know, in the premium package, heated front seats, the LED headlamps and tail lamps, and it had the 8-inch navigation touchscreen. So even in the SE, the base setup, you know, you still get an 8-inch screen, 8-inch touchscreen. And Hyundai, you know, always does really good screens. They're very high quality screens, very legible. You know, good contrast, and they don't get washed out in sunlight, and they're visible with sunglasses on. So, you know, this one had the optional navigation, but you know, you can always forgo that, and came to $23,405, including delivery charge. So, you know, I think, a really good value.
Wait, how much was it?
$23,400, including delivery.
That's cheap.
Yeah.
It starts at $19,800. Yeah. And I think I love how many safety features they put in this, that you don't have to check every box, you know, that it comes out of the box. It comes really well equipped, I think.
Yeah. Forward collision alert, lane keeping assist,
blind spot.
The blind spot monitoring is part of the premium package.
Blind spot collision warning.
I'm
looking at a 2021, so they may have added, but rear cross traffic warning. I mean, those are just like nice. Those are good things to. They're kind of like a reward. I feel like, you know, like we're gonna take care of you, whether you're spending.
Yeah, and fortunately, the industry as a whole is moving in this direction of making a lot of those driver assist features standard equipment.
Yeah.
Even on entry level models like this. So, you know, I think that's, you know, that's a great trend. You know, I'm glad to see it happen. You know, so things like automatic emergency braking and collision avoidance, and you know, I think those are all really good features to have. And it's good that they're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Dan.
Well, so I was driving another small SUV. This one was from Kia. I tried the Seltos SX Turbo all-wheel drive, basically the most loaded Kia Seltos you could get, which rang up just under $30,000. And it's a pretty good value for that price. It's really a design masterpiece. I just loved looking at this car. It outside and in, there's just clever details everywhere. You know, the metal around the grill has this pattern that is, you know, stamped into it, but it sort of fades as it gets to areas where it has to curve and stuff around, like the lights and the grill opening and stuff. So it's just really nicely detailed, and that extends into the interior, the shapes of the dashboard and the controls and everything all look very premium, and like with the Venue, the plastics and stuff, the materials look good. Some of them are hard, but they're pleasing to the eye, and I think that's important. You know, it looks premium. It looks like $1 million. I was a little disappointed.
Or at least $100,000.
Yeah, let's say $100,000. I was a little disappointed that the driving experience didn't quite live up to it. You know, it drove like a, you know, $20,000 car, because that's exactly what it is. You know, which is fine. It's honest in its driving experience, but it's a little loud on the road. You can hear the suspension doing its thing. Sometimes there was some noise from the back. I couldn't ever find it. You know, whether I didn't know whether it was, you know, it seemed like maybe torsion on the body would make the hatch make a little noise here and there. I'm not sure, and sometimes press cars do that because they are treated mercilessly. So don't take that for anything other than, like, I noticed a little noise in this particular one for certain things.
And as a press car, it's more than likely that what you were driving was actually a pre-production model.
Yeah, it could be. And it's not uncommon. You know, I didn't notice it, like, out on the road, but it's not uncommon when there are cars where I'll back them in and out of the driveway or something, and just the combination of going over the driveway apron and having the wheel turned and stuff, it sets up torsion in the structure. And even my Jeep, I can hear, you know, I can hear stuff move a little bit. That's not uncommon. It's normal. It's just sometimes you hear it a little more than the others, and it just made me wonder what was going on. But it drives like a $20,000 car, which is not necessarily an insult to it. It's a very honest driving experience. Like I said, it feels good. And actually, if you were to drive it in sport mode, and you can nudge the shifter over into sport mode as well, the SX Turbo has a 7-speed dual clutch transmission. It all gets pretty responsive. And because it's the SX Turbo, it also has a multi-link rear suspension versus a beam axle that some of the lower trims have. It'll go around corners and stuff. Its limits are pretty low, but it'll do your bidding in a pretty trusty manner. So it feels like it was tuned well, which is not the case for Kia models sort of going back, right? They would have everything there on paper, and then you'd try to drive it and make use of that capability, and it would just dynamically fall apart. So they've made progress there. It's really pleasant to drive. I liked it quite a bit, other than the road noise. You know, I found it to be kind of loud, but you know, the turbo engine has 175 horsepower, 195 pound-feet of torque from a 1.6 liter. So we've driven this engine in a bunch of other stuff before. It's good. It's smooth. It sounds good. It works really well with the transmission. I would have liked to try it with the CVT. But I think that would have limited me to the 2-liter that you get in trims like the S and the whatever. I think LX and maybe the EX. I forget where the turbo comes in. It's optional pretty largely across the board too. So the
was
ride.
Yours front wheel
oh, go
drive
ahead.
Or, I'm sorry. Was yours front wheel drive or all wheel drive?
Because
they
this
do
was
offer
all-wheel drive.
All wheel drive in this one. Okay.
It was all wheel drive.
Okay.
And it was good. It has all the ADAS, which is pretty unobtrusive. The lane centering isn't great. The steering gets a little notchy, and I thought it was pretty funny when I was driving it on some back roads. Did you ever get that indicator that lights up, but the car is like, "Hey, you should stop for a while"?
Yeah, that never happens.
Yeah.
No, I don't know what you mean.
Yeah.
15 minutes into my driving.
Yeah, it was like, you must be tired. Take a break. So I got that a few times, which is totally my fault, but I love that it's there. It just cracks me up when it comes up. It's like, I am more awake right now, Buster. It has adaptive cruise, has lane centering, blind spot monitoring, the forward collision alert, all of it's, that's a pretty good suite of stuff for a vehicle that rings up under 30 grand. It's roomy. The back seat is pretty good. When, I set my front seat where I wanted it, I felt like there was quite a bit of space, to sit behind myself. so it's a really good, vehicle for its segment. It has a lot of competition, and it's going to attract people who like the style. But I think that, even the RAV4 or the CR-V are probably a little quieter, and that might sway some people, because I feel like that's what lets it down, is just the driving experience. That's a little stiff-kneed, a little less plush than you might think looking at it, versus and that road noise versus something that's a little softer and a little quieter, that just by that very nature can feel a little bit more luxurious or just sort of well put together. Overall, Hyundai and Kia, they're just killing it. I loved looking at the car. I loved sort of just all the details that they put in it. And that really, for me, I would find myself like rinsing the coffee cup, just staring out the window at it. Like, oh, that's a really interesting detail. So,
it's a good looking little vehicle.
Yeah. And we're in this place, right, where, okay, cars are kind of, sedans and coupes and whatever, they're kind of going away, but that doesn't mean that you can't have vehicles that are enjoyable. And then I really enjoyed the restraint and the maturity of the design. There's not a lot of gingerbread on it, so I think that's great. And it got 26.5 miles per gallon, which isn't terrible. And it is a really good all-arounder, in the same way that like a Forester is a really good all-arounder. It's I don't think it's quite as roomy as a Forester, but it's got a lot more panache.
No, it does. I think it's so Nicole Wakeland, who I think we know, she writes for my site. Sam, yeah. What's the site?
RebeccaDrives.com.
Thank you.
Well, right now she's on the Rebel Rally, isn't she? Or
she is on the Rebel Rally, yeah. But she wrote this Kia Seltos review that's on the site.
She drove the same one.
Drive the same one.
She's
cites
New Hampshire.
Right, and she cites a lot of the same things that you said about it. I think the one that I had was like a total pre-production. It didn't even have, I think we talked about this one, it didn't have a push button start. Like I tried to build it and you can't actually build it. But the way it was configured, it was
this one definitely had a push button start, and the infotainment is good. Infotainment is quite good. So
yeah, no, that's very good. But no, she cites a lot of the same things. But the one thing that struck me is while you were speaking is that the top trim actually tops out at $32,000, which I seems really, really high. I mean, it starts at 23, but
that's 23 with destination, right? What's destination? Because destination has to be almost $1,000.
Yeah, it's over $1,000.
Yeah,
but you can certainly chart this thing up.
Yeah,
you can chart this baby up to 32,000. So
right,
but no, she said a lot of the same things. That you did, to nice and roomy, and the 1.6 liter. So yeah, it's probably the same.
Yeah. Did she give you pictures?
No, she didn't. Unfortunately,
I guarantee you it's the same car. but I did miss, paddle shifters. It doesn't have paddle shifters. It has a manual mode that's decently responsive, but it also shifts. It won't bounce off the rev limiter at red line, so it'll shift for you, which is fine. You know, it's not slushy about it, but it's interesting to see where they've made the compromises. And I think they've made the right ones overall. You know, that's really what I sort of walked away with, was saying, you know, there's compromises that they clearly made to bring this vehicle in. I didn't find it terribly expensive at $30K. Like, it didn't have a sunroof, which you may be able to add and drive the price up a little bit more, but it was very well equipped.
Yeah.
And you could definitely, in the lower trims, get all of the value, or, you know, the value goes up because you're not really going to miss a lot of the stuff that the SX Turbo had. And you'll save some cash.
Yeah.
It's going to be just about as friendly, even with the beam axle, you know, which is, in the lower trims and the less powerful engine. I don't really think you give up a lot. The powerful engine is nice, but it's not that powerful.
So. Right. Well, as you say, it doesn't weigh a ton. So yeah. The 2.0 liter four cylinder and versus the 1.6 liter turbo, it's a different experience, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the 1.6 is, you know, it's a little smaller displacement wise. It might be a little smoother. Mm-hmm. It is a smooth engine. It doesn't sound bad when you let it run out to redline or anything. So it's not one of those four cylinders that just lets you know it's unhappy.
Yeah.
you know, like the Honda four cylinder now does not sound good. This one sounds good. So awesome. Yeah, it's a solid vehicle. It's funny because I stepped into a Rogue, a brand new Rogue this week. I've only had it a couple of days, but my first impression was like, damn, it's quiet in here.
Oh, you got the new 21 Rogue.
I love this size of vehicle, though. I think it's perfect for, you know, somebody that wants a small SUV, doesn't want the, you know, the larger versions of these. I love that there's so much choice in this space.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really easy to get in and out of because it's a little bit higher off the ground. This, the, you know, in the higher trim, it's got the LED lights that are very good. So it's one of those things. It's like, yeah, it's another winner. There's things to criticize about it, but there's things to criticize about everything else in the segment too. So,
and we really have to pick a lot of nits, you know, to find those things in most cases on many of these vehicles.
Yeah, no, for sure.
You know, it would be nice for sort of the full boat to have stuff like shift paddles, have a sunroof. You know, but again, it's like where'd they save the money, and they probably made the right choices to save the money and bring it in for a price that is a little bit more palatable. So.
Well, one thing that's interesting that I've noticed, you know, especially this past week, you know, is getting, you know, these smaller and smaller slices of the market, you know. So in the compact crossover market, you know, you've got the small compact, you know. So there's the subcompact stuff like the Venue and the Kona, and then there's the small end of the compact market, which is where you find things like the Mazda CX-30 and the Seltos, and then, you know, the upper end of that segment, you know, where you get into the CRV and RAV4 and Escape and that. And, you know, just this week, you know, there was another new entry in this small compact with the VW Taos. Right.
Yes.
And we can talk about that a little more next week. You know, the Taos, you know, is in that same size class. It's actually just slightly bigger. It's like 175 inches long versus 173 for the Seltos. There's 172 and 173 for the CX-30. You know, but it's interesting how they're getting these smaller and smaller niches that they're filling, you know, and, you know, having the pricing go along with that size. As you go up in size, the price, you know, you're getting a little more premium, a little pricier. And, you know, so like the Taos fits right in this same segment, you know, in terms of size and pricing.
Yeah, no, that's a great call for sure. Yeah.
Well, and it's not like it's a fully new vehicle. They've gotten very good at taking platforms and making them slightly bigger, slightly smaller. You know, I mean, look at BMW. BMW's trying to fill all the white space.
Yeah.
It's like, it's going to
be better or for worse.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, VW is a perfect example. You know, they've got their MQB architecture, which is really more of a toolkit, you know, a bin of parts that they can mix and match in all kinds of different ways. And they use MQB for everything from the Polo, which is their subcompact hatchback that they sell in Europe, all the way up to the Atlas. And everything in between is all based off MQB.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So that's impressive.
Yeah. So we had a pretty good run of cars this week.
Yeah.
So we're joined right now by Jonathan Klinger from Hagerty Insurance. Jonathan joins us from all the way out on the, you're like way on the lakeside over as about as far as you can get from Detroit.
That's right.
At least in the lower peninsula.
You bet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the real question is, where are you on the mitten?
Well,
you're the pinky.
We are the pinky. Yep. That's the famous thing. Hold up your hand and we are between the pinky and the index finger.
Nice.
And that's how you know that you're talking to a real Michigander, right?
That's right.
All right, so you're here to talk to us about what the state of the market, or what do you want to talk about, Jonathan?
Hey, anything in the fun to drive category, but I mean, just like everybody, it's been an interesting year, right?
I bet.
Why don't we start off with, you know, what Hagerty is? Because, you know, I mean, Hagerty is just not your average car insurance company. You guys are different.
So, I thought they were a content shop now.
Well, there's that too. I mean, so Jonathan, you know, why don't you tell us about Hagerty first? Let's set the stage with that, and then we can dive into some of the other stuff.
Yeah, and I'll take a couple of minutes to just give a brief synopsis of the history, because I think that I find that fascinating. So Frank Hagerty moved to Traverse City, and in 1956, he, as a young person, opened a State Farm insurance agency. So he was like your local insurance agent. And in the late 70s, had the opportunity to sell, and so kind of found himself in a midlife retirement and didn't work for a couple of years. He was always a car guy, always liked restoring classic boats. And so for a couple of years, he got a chance to focus on some projects that he had lingering out behind the garage, like many of us do. And when he was working on these vintage wooden boats, he discovered that no one, and this is in the early 80s, no one would insure a wooden boat. And the insurance industry collectively looked at wood boats as nothing more than floating pieces of firewood filled with gas.
That's exactly what they are. And
a claim waiting to happen.
Exactly. And Frank's argument was, wait a minute, those of us that are crazy enough to use these things, we're probably the most careful of any boat owner out on the water. So why wouldn't you insure them? And so what happened was, there was this unmet need out there, and he took his years of experience of being an insurance agent and got an underwriter to back him and launched what in the early days, in 1984 precisely, was the Hagerty Classic Marine Insurance Agency. And all they did was specialize in insuring wood boats until 1991. You know, as they were slowly growing, there was many owners of classic wooden boats that also had classic cars. And they're like, well, could you do this? And so then that was what started into the classic car. And then, of course, now, you know, fast forward all these years later, we still do insure wooden boats, but that's about 2% of the business.
And this was all up in Traverse City, or did
all
he expand?
Up in Traverse City.
Okay.
Well, it started in Traverse City in the basement of their house, you know, hand stuffing envelopes for the annual renewals. Actually, that house is less than 3 miles from where I'm sitting right now.
That's cool.
It's a fascinating beginning that how this happened. And And so now, you know, fast forward, Hagerty is the largest insurer of classic, collectible, and enthusiast vehicles, and that's from a global standpoint. And then in more recent years, we've really aggressively grown our magazine, Hagerty Drivers Club magazine, and all the content that surrounds that. And then also, for more than a decade now, have published the Hagerty Price Guide. So think of it, you know, you're used to the Kelley Blue Book or the NADA guide. This is the valuation guide for the most commonly traded collector vehicles.
So it's not a general market guide. It's just, no. It's okay. Yeah. But you do keep track though of the market and what's going on in the new and used car market.
We do. We do. And we're always adding new vehicles to the Hagerty Price Guide. But it's focused on enthusiast oriented vehicles. So there's vehicles that are brand new on there, but again, it's not your typical daily regular use vehicles that you're going to find.
So what do you think has been the biggest change, you know, during COVID in terms of classic cars and in terms of collectibles? And has the market gone up or down or stagnant? Just tell us, I'm really curious about that.
Well, the market has been fascinating. So the biggest changes, and this probably won't surprise any of us, is people are driving more. So people have, specifically to their classic collector vehicles.
You know, well, they're driving more for pleasure as opposed to work.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, many people have found more time at home than you know, prior to this year. We could all agree to that. But, you know, think even in the depths of the shutdowns in the early days of the pandemic when people were truly being isolated at home, if just think of your, you know, a family, so a married couple and maybe some kids still at home, and if all of a sudden both working spouses are now working from home and you're leaving the house once or twice a week and only one of you are going to the grocery store, if you've got the minivan and the SUV and the Corvette sitting in the garage and it's just you, what are you going to take? You're probably going to take the Corvette.
I was going to say, probably the minivan to get the groceries.
Absolutely. Power doors. And you take a scenic route to the grocery store, you know, drive, you know, 30 or 40 miles, you know, the countryside.
Well, it's true, because it's like, look, you can only stare at the four walls for so long, and it's like this little bit of solace, especially if you're all kind of on top of each other. I don't know how big of a house you actually need to not feel like you're on top of each other, but I don't have it. And, so it's like driving or like the bathroom are the two times you get alone time.
That's right. Well, and there has been multiple studies where people select that undeniably the second most safest place they feel is in their car. So the safest they feel is in their home. They're dwelling in the second most secure place is in their own car. And if you're looking for an escape from the home, you're going to get in your car and drive somewhere and just drive somewhere for fun. So it in some ways, you know, despite all of the turmoil with the pandemic, the fact that people have rediscovered the joy of just going for the Sunday drive or, you know, taking a more scenic route to your end of destination, I think that's kind of a good thing for the car hobby that's going to come out of this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember having my media car was a Bentley of all things. And there was, you know, there was no traffic and we could go across the Tappan Zee Bridge at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, it was amazing to not have any constraints on leaving your house. You know, when you left your house, you didn't have to factor in Waze anymore and computer and, you know, the commute. And I loved it. I mean, I'm thankful that, you know, people are coming back to work, but gosh, that was fun.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, something, and we can dedicate an entire episode just to what I'm about to say, but this is a trend that's been happening for the past 5 years or a little more, but is continuing to accelerate is, you know, to your point, you had a Bentley as a press car. Modern brand new cars are just continue to get better and better. I mean, yes, there's little nuances that we can pick at, but they continue to get better and better. And just before we started recording, we were debating, you know, the hypothetical, would you rather have a GT350 or GT500 in your garage? They're both amazing cars, especially for what they cost, you know, the performance of the dollar. So what we have been watching and witnessing for several years now on the enthusiast side is there's an awful lot of long time collectors. So people would have the vehicles you would expect to see in their garages, a muscle car from the 60s and 70s, some great European sports car. You know, throughout their life, have these cars have multiplied as they kind of get to, you know, post-retirement years. 2, 3, 4 of those cars are being sold, and they're buying 1 or 2 really cool modern performance cars because they're just so good.
Yeah.
They're good, and they have a warranty, and they have working air conditioning and all of that. And you know, the disclaimer I put out there, I'm not disparaging old cars at all. I mean, I'm a huge diehard fan of old cars. The oldest I currently own is a 1930. But modern cars are really, really darn good from an enthusiast standpoint.
Yeah, they are. You know, when back last December, when Ford was doing the media drive for the GT500 out in Las Vegas, you were out there. You'd brought out the 67 GT500 from the Hagerty collection, and we went for a drive in that. You know, I'd been driving the new GT500 earlier that morning, and then we went out for, you know, for a short little drive in the 67, and it's, you know, as good as the 67 was in its time. You know, compared to any modern car, you know, it was totally, I mean, the brakes and the steering were terrible. You know, it wasn't anywhere near as fast, you know, and, you know, if you, you know, hit anything, you know, you're likely to die, but.
Well, and the FE's not exactly a revver either, right? Like the.
Oh, no. And it's heavy too.
Yeah.
Heavy up front.
I bet it looked and sounded pretty damn good though.
Oh yeah. Amazing. You know, I still like driving old cars. You know, it's not, you know, from a purely objective standpoint, yeah, they're not anywhere near as good as a modern car, but you know, from a subjective standpoint and the visceral experience of driving a car like that, you know, it's something totally different.
Well, even when we were in your Miata, you know, how we talked about this before, you sit like. The belt line is so much lower that I remember when we first got on the highway and I was like, wow, I feel like I'm halfway out of the car. But it just added to the whole experience of being in that classic, you know, sports car kind of feel. And as opposed to like the Lexus LC 500, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous convertible, but you know, you're sitting even lower or even, you know, the new Miata, I mean, which is again, fabulous, but you sit lower in it. And so you don't have that same sort of feeling of really being exposed, you know, for better or for worse. But no, the Miata, the original Miata is just such a classic still.
You're absolutely right. You not only do you sit lower, but the body, the belt line, it's higher.
Right.
And it's all, and mostly driven by the superior crash test ratings that modern vehicles have, but it has shrunk the greenhouse of what you have in today's cars, and pillars are so much thicker, and that's why you have all these blind spot warning indicators. But yeah, you even get into a vehicle from the late 90s and early 2000s compared to new cars, and you're like, wow, this is like a glass dome.
Yeah. Look at all this glass.
Like my elbow is not at my ear when I put my arm on the door. So I have a question. And so first, do you guys do RV insurance?
We do not yet.
Okay.
Yes, as far as vintage RVing, that is something that we have looked in, and it is something that will come in the future.
Because, yeah, because
again, vintage RV, and that's a growing trend.
Right. That's especially now. Like I found it really interesting to watch, and like everybody had this collective urge all at once. We're all just like, I want a damn RV for the summer.
Well, I mean, but I to his earlier somewhere. Point, like that's
right.
Right, we're all trapped at home.
Yeah, and so and you can't, like, everything is closed, so you got to stay, like, here in Massachusetts. Like we couldn't go to Maine; they were closed unless we had tests and stuff like that. So you wind up going, well, okay, I've got to quarantine somewhere, so you kind of want to just go somewhere else and still, you know, not necessarily take vacation but work from home. So everybody bought RVs this summer.
And that's right.
Everybody was sold out. And then the idea of the vintage RV was like, well, they're cool. They're really quaint on the inside. You can restore them. And they especially if it's something like an Airstream, they still hold their value. So it's just, I see it as a rising trend, and it just sort of took off this year.
Yeah. Well, and there's a one of the groups, anyways, that has a pretty significant national footprint are the Tin Can Tourists.
Yeah.
you know, all the vintage RVers that meet up at different campgrounds and have, I would say cruisins. I don't know if that's the proper term. Forgive me if I'm butchering this. In the
We're going to get hate mail.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, but the thing is, you know, I've just had just a surface introduction into that world. And you want to talk about a group of enthusiasts that takes the full experience. You know, not only do they have these either wonderfully preserved or very well restored vintage RVs, it's the furniture, what they set out outside of their trailer. I mean, everything is very era appropriate. Some people are cooking recipes from that era, and it's
eat a lot of spam.
That's right. This is when margarine was revolutionary, ladies and gentlemen.
Martinis.
Yeah, margarine that you have to like mix the food coloring in. Yeah. And the GM RVs too. The GMCs, yes. With the Toronado powertrain.
Yeah, the front drive ones. Yes, that is one I would want.
Yeah, so there's a lot of cool stuff. Yeah.
A neighbor down the street who moved away last fall actually bought or had one of those GMC motorhomes that they got a couple of years ago. It was in their driveway for a while. And, I mean, those things are – I always – from the time I was a kid, I always thought those were the coolest-looking RVs. And at one point, I actually had a Hot Wheels one of those.
Yeah, I have the Matchbox. I repainted it once when I was a kid, yeah.
Yeah, they were really ahead of their time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they're not gigantic. You know, it's not a 45-foot motor coach with a steerable tag axle.
So, you know, the first time you and I met, Jonathan, was a few years ago when you were participating in the Great Race and stopped off here in Ypsilanti on this race from Florida to Traverse City. And you were driving a really amazing car on that race, the Green Dragon.
The Green Dragon, yes. The 1917 Peerless.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, with a Peerless V8. So one of the early V8 engines from a U.S. production car, and it was, yes, absolutely love that car. It's Peerless. I don't know if you've heard this term, the three P's of luxury, but in the teens through the 20s, that was. I don't know if you call it slang, but three P's of luxury referred to Packard, Peerless, and Piercera. Hmm. So three American auto manufacturers that focus on luxury. Peerless, where they absolutely excelled was in the mechanics. They put an awful lot of effort into that V8 engine that came out in 1916, shortly after Cadillac's V8 engine. It was a very well balanced, smooth running, reliable V8, and the cars drove very well. What they did not focus on nearly as much as other luxury automakers at the time was styling. So a stock Peerless automobile, it was pretty, you know, there was nothing extraordinary about its styling. It looked like an awful lot of other cars on the road, but they were powerful. They were very reliable. They were smooth running. And, you know, I have to believe that, of course, an awful lot of automakers died off shortly before the Depression. But the fact that they didn't put an emphasis on styling, especially through the 20s, the exciting days of the roaring 20s, certainly had to contribute to their demise. But this 1917 Peerless makes for a wonderful, wonderful cross-country rally car.
Yeah, I mean, seeing that thing, you know, you're sitting way up high, completely out in the open in that thing, that would have been an amazing ride to go a couple of thousand miles in.
Yes, yeah, you feel every ounce of weather. But let's see if I can pull up a photo here, at least for the four of us to see it. But it's, you know, the funny thing was, everything is all relative. So here's a car that's more than 100 years old. In the Great Race, which is a cross-country time, speed, distance, endurance rally. And every day there was official lunch stop and overnight evening stops. And of course they would draw crowds like what you saw, Sam. And a lot of people would come up and see this open cockpit, fenderless car, and they'd say, man, how fast does this thing go? and when I would say 65, they would be like, what?
Listen, it feels like 300.
Exactly. And, allegedly it went 90. I never drove at 90, and I don't think I ever would drive at 90. But,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was saying it's 80 horsepower, 330 cubic inches, 80 horsepower, very torquey engine, heavy flywheel, low compression, 5.5 to 1 compression ratio. So very low
crank start.
It does have electric start.
Okay.
You could crank start it. But I very much appreciated the electric starter. And, and it worked 99% of the time.
The crank starting is like, that's a lost art. It's not just as simple as turning the crank. You have to know where to set the timing and
yes.
set the throttle. And you have to know actually where compression is, because it'll break your arm if you're not careful.
That's right. So one of the cooler experiences, and this absolutely was a bucket list thing for me. So yeah, you can see the car here. You see that V8 engine. Interestingly enough, cast aluminum crankcase with cast iron cylinder jugs. Doesn't have a head. It was a whole jug, kind of like on a more recent snowmobile engine. But just a neat car. 33-inch wheels.
And where is that all original paint and color?
So like green this and car yellow? Was no. So this car started out life as a passenger car, probably a touring or a sedan body, and at some point in the 20s, it was converted into a board track racer, not driven by anybody famous that we know of or in any sort of famous race. It would be like any one of us, modifying our late model Miata and doing some amateur racing. This was that equivalent in the 20s. And in the 30s, it was tucked away into a barn, and then it sat in the barn until the late 80s. And the previous owner of this car, John Hollinsworth, great car collector down in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, he liked doing these cross-country road rallies. And the racing body that was on it when he found it, which was really, really crude to begin with, it was too far gone. So that's a rebody. That's a rebody in the 90s. And it was customized to be a little bit more convenient for driving cross country, a little bit more storage space. Of course, it's all relatively speaking. It still has hardly any storage space, but it has more than it would have. Mechanically, that engine, the transmission, the chassis, that's all from 1917, and it was rebuilt.
That's cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love the leather straps too. Keeping
that's
it all
right.
together.
Yeah. So you're talking about crank starting. I had and this for me, loving early cars and early automotive history. I participated in the London and Brighton Veteran Car Run in England last November. And if you're not familiar with that event, it is the longest running motoring racing event. The newest the car can be is 1904.
Oh my gosh.
The newest the vehicle that you can enter is 1904. And there was three of us that piloted a 1903 Knox, KNOX. It was an American car built in Massachusetts. And it has a single cylinder engine. And so, yes, that was, talk about crank starting and knowing exactly where compression is certainly is a sense of accomplishment if you do everything right and it lights off on the first crank.
Was that a three-wheeler or was that a four-wheeler?
It was a four-wheeler, but it's still, this is the nickname horseless carriage, you know, it exists for a reason because it looks like the horse just simply ran away.
You know? This literally looks like a carriage.
No, I mean the old stuff is cool. I remember the the old marine ratchet engines that they didn't have a reverse gear. You just spin it the other way.
That's right.
If you got good at it, you could bounce it off compression backwards. So if you wanted to go forward, just bounce the flywheel, and it would, you know, they're neat toys. And so the old stuff is really, really fascinating.
It's an experience in itself.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your year driving the Ford Model A as your daily driver.
Yeah, so it's hard to
that's
believe.
A modern car. It's got a roof and everything.
A windshield wiper, yeah.
One wiper.
I call it a swiper. So it's hard to believe that 10 years ago this month is when I started doing that. So from October of 2010 until October of 2011, I parked my modern vehicles, and the only car that I drove daily for straight 365 days was a 1930 Ford Model A two-door sedan. And it was just before I turned 30. Actually, the day that I ended this 365 days was on my 30th birthday.
Which was October what?
October 5th.
Oh, interesting. My birthday's October 13th.
Well, there you go. There you go. Some fellow Libras here.
Fellow Libras.
And so kind of the whole reason for that was just to kind of prove that old cars can be driven. They are reliable. And really, you know, if you think back 10 years ago, there was just this exponential growth in television and online programming in the vintage car space, that so much of it was focused on the sale of the vehicle, you know, how much you could, you know, how much something sold for, or how much you could buy something and flip it for. And of course, what makes for good television is the higher dollar figures, you know, six and seven figures and beyond. And I just kind of wanted to prove that, you know, you could do that. You don't have to have $100,000 sitting in a checking account to go buy a vintage car. And so I bought it off of Craigslist from an elderly couple in Indiana, paid $11,000 for it. The whole idea was going to buy it, drive it for a year, then sell it for the same amount of money. But then, of course, you put 17,000 miles on it and have it in seven states and drive it every day through the winter. And, you know, we kind of bonded together. So it is still part of my world. It did not get sold.
But I also heard that you inspired a young man from Australia to.
Well, this has been the heartwarming part of it. And actually, I just recently received an email from a, I guess he'd be 22 now, young guy from Germany, saying that he said, I was 12 years old when you did the 365 days of A, and I read your blog. My parents did not support my interest in old cars, but he just bought in Germany a 1930 Model A, and he's driving it.
That's 10 awesome.
Years later. And I thought, I mean, it just, like, when I got that, when I received that email, and I just received it, I haven't actually responded to him. I choked up. It was just like, oh my gosh. Like, and it was just all about sharing the experience of, it sounds cliche, but sharing the experience of life in the slow lane, you know, taking the more scenic, interesting route to get to your destination and, you know, kind of taking time to enjoy the world around you, because the world at 47 miles an hour is a lot different than 75. And the reason I say 47 is because 47 miles an hour was the absolute sweet spot for that car. All the sounds and vibrations harmonized at 47.
I was just gonna say, yeah. Like, I choke up when I get reader email too, because, like, you know, somebody read the thing I wrote.
That's right.
But the A is, it's one of those things that, you know, people feel really far away from the older cars. And I think one of the things that drives that is stuff like the Model T was made for so long. But really, once you get into the 30s, the cars are quite quite similar to what you'd expect now. There's a few different controls, but especially a late 30s car, it's not really all that alien to what we're driving today.
Yeah, they are a, by the simplest of definitions, they are a conventional automobile.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting. And here's another fun subject that it would be fun to talk about with amongst the four of us is, you're right. I mean, the fundamental similarities are all there. But, you know, one of the things that we've done for, it'll be 10 years in 2021 at Hagerty is what's called the Hagerty Driving Experience, where we go around to different venues around the country and we teach young drivers how to drive manual transmission. And not only that, we teach them how to drive manual transmission in vintage cars. So kind of give them, you know, that dual experience. And it's on a closed course, and it's meant to be introductory. This is how a clutch works. This is how you take off. I'm going to start with the clutch, and it's slow speed. But it's been fascinating over the past decade of being involved in these events, of witnessing 16, 17, 18-year-olds, so, you know, new drivers, and even just vocabulary, like young people, you don't start the car. You don't start the engine. You turn it on.
Yeah.
Because you push the button.
Yeah.
And that's what they're all learning to drive in most cases. And that's their only experience. And I started, because I, you know, again, we're doing this event in vintage cars. So we usually have a 63 Corvette. My Model A has been used on a lot of them. You know, but, you know, all vintage cars. And of course, people, as they're learning, if this is their first time, they're in inevitably going to stall at some point. And so you talk them through, okay, start it up again. And they just blip the ignition switch as if you were pushing the button.
Now you got to hold that. So yeah. And these are cars, like your A has the starter on the floor, right?
It does. Yeah. So that's even a whole nother, level. But then it's like, no, you got to hold it till the engine starts. So then they hold the key until the engine starts, but then they overrun the starter.
Yeah.
So
it's got to dig into your thumb, and then you got to let it go, and you got to make sure you're there with the gas so that you feather the pedal. So it's,
that's right, and so yeah, it's this concept of starting the engine. This isn't there, because even if you take a my daily driver is a 2012 F-150 as far as my winter vehicle here in Northern Michigan. And yes, it has, you still stick a key into the ignition tumbler and turn it. But it's, you know, when you turn the key to the start position, you're basically just requesting of the computer that it start the engine. I mean, it does it for you. You know, you're not going to overrun the starter or anything like that. And so no fault to young people. They don't have the experience of the concept of starting an engine.
Yeah, well, I think that's an important point. You just said, like, no fault to them. It's like, because that's one of the things that I've seen in the hobby, sort of my entire time of being an enthusiast. Coming up through the 80s, there was always that derision on the cars that are now, I'm sure, are quite hot. You're starting to see, especially with the rise of events like Radwood, a lot of stuff from the late 70s through late 90s. Mm-hmm. A lot more popular, going for a lot bigger prices, because those were the things that we could afford. And there was that exclusivity where it was only sock hops and, 57 Chevys and stuff.
Oh,
and all that stuff is cool. But, the stuff that I have direct experience with, like, I find it's weird that you can collect a rapt audience just talking about the crappy beater you had because you know all the ins and outs of it. And,
That's right.
People are like, how do you know this stuff? I'm like, I bought a $500 car, man. And I had to put it on the road.
That's right.
It was a piece of crap. It broke all the time.
Yeah. When I was, when I turned 16 in 98, and I grew up in a farming family in Northern Illinois, big Ford family. I always wanted a Mustang, but I couldn't afford the Mustang that I wanted. And so what I ended up with was the closest thing I could even come was a 91 Mercury Cougar that had the 5.0 in it, So it was my total poor man's Mustang.
Hey, it had that big formal roof line. You're good.
That's right.
That was an MN12. I mean, you had independent rear suspension
that's
and everything
right.
in that.
That's right. And so, gosh, I guess it was 3 years ago now, I stumbled across, like I was not searching for it, but I stumbled across a trade-in in a Chrysler dealer down in north of Detroit, of a 91 Cougar LS with the 5.0 that had 35,000 miles on it. It had never been driven.
Practically new.
Yeah, someone bought this, and I'll tell the story. You know, the salesperson probably listening to this, but they were asking $8,000 for it, and I called up and asked to talk to the used car sales manager, and they're like, and of course he gives you what you'd expect to hear, and it's the cleanest thing you've ever seen, and this is going to be a collector, and. I said, yeah, you know, it looks great. And I said, I'm gonna offer you $2,500. And he, of course, was just, yeah, that was his reaction. He's just like, what? You know? And I just said, what? This car is kind of in purgatory, or it lives in you know, this like no person's land, because collectors are not seeking out 91 Mercury Cougars.
They're not rare.
And someone who is in the market for an $8,000 used car does not want something that doesn't have anti-lock brakes, that does not have air brakes. Yeah, so there's one idiot out there that wants this car, and you're talking to him, and here's his offer. And so, of course, you know, he just thought I was crazy, and I thought he was crazy, and so we ended as friends. And about every 6 weeks, I would give the same salesperson a call. And I would reaffirm my offer.
Did you sell it yet? Is it pulled into the line?
Yeah, every time it was like, oh, someone from Ohio is coming up to look at it. Well, good luck. I hope you sell it. And so fast forward to November. This is still on the lot. And of course, they had slowly started dropping the price. And he actually called me and says, hey, we're down to $4,500. What do you think? I said, we're getting close. We're only $2,000 apart. The ending of the story is the week of Thanksgiving, I went down and picked it up. I came up $500. I bought it for $3,000. But I don't know if the camera's going to allow, but this is me at Radwood, at Radwood, Detroit, and in 2019, last year.
That's
with
awesome.
With this cream puff of a 91 Mercury Cougar, which is an example of what my first car was.
I just love that there's that room, that space that's being created for the inclusivity and for folks to share. You know, there's the older guys. So I found this when I was 20, 25 years ago when I was much younger. We had a really hacked together, a friend of mine had a hacked together tea bucket that was not like the other tea buckets. It actually had a 12A rotary in it. It was much smaller. It was freaking terrifying. But you parked it among all of the other tea buckets that were mostly built out of a catalog. And the old guys would look at it and they say, well, what's that? And so I'm explaining, like, we needed headlights because we were going to drive it around here at night and it didn't have any headlights. So I had to put a relay in. And so I'm just, explaining all this stuff. And, so then they got to sharing. And so that opportunity to sort of share across generations is really, I think, key to the experience of older cars. I hope that we can continue to be inclusive versus, some of the sort of walls that go up around stuff. I mean, I love the 60s and 70s, muscle cars as much as anybody, but there's a lot to like in any different period.
And I think some of these recent events, so here at Radwood, that's what we've been talking about, I think is an excellent example of the types of events that are going to continue to thrive, because yes, it is a car show, but it really is a
cultural thing.
It's a cultural thing. And it's like, Shelley and I, when we drove the Cougar from Traverse City down to Detroit for that Radwood event, we like really got into it as far as what our outfit was going to be. Totally dressed up. And by the way, I never dressed to that extreme in the 90s.
Yes, you did.
Oh, yeah.
The big Z Cavarici shoulder
pads.
Yeah, I went like, remember when it was like you know, it was like just obnoxious brand labels.
Yep.
So I went
Jordache jeans.
I went full Tommy Hilfiger. I had a pair of Tommy Hilfiger cut off overalls or bib overalls. So of course, you know, with the one strap.
Yeah, one strap down. Yeah.
And a button down long sleeve Tommy Hilfiger shirt with way too many logos on it. And Tommy socks, Tommy shoes. I mean, the only thing I didn't have was I did not have the pager in the side pocket.
Right.
And Shelly was dressed similarly, but it was just fun, you know. And this is a for-profit event, you know, that the organizers that have created it and running it, it's, you know, it's their business, and they've been successful at it. And, you know, because so long for all of us growing up, the idea of a car show was you went to some local park on a Saturday afternoon. There was the crying doll leaning against the bumper of a 57 Chevy.
Oh.
Chantilly Lace was playing in the background. You know, you just had, it was just like this playbook of what a car show was. And
yeah, all the signs say, don't touch.
Yeah, exactly. Don't touch. All the car owners would sit in a lawn chair and match to their car all day. They'd have their lookbook. Here's how horrible it was when I started, and here it is now, and the mirrors underneath, and you know, and that's fine for someone who really truly enjoys that aspect of it. But to me, I love like the Radwood events. Yes, the cars are a lot of fun. It was fun driving to the event, but there's just a lighthearted casualness mixed with a sense of humor, and again, it was more of this cultural thing.
It's less about how much the car is worth and more about the memories associated with it.
Exactly.
Yeah, there were a lot of scruffy cars at Radwood, and that's not a pejorative. Like, I like the scruffy cars, you know?
No, because the stories are so much better.
Well, and that's that's what we drove, you know? The nicest cars we drove, I mean, I graduated high school in 95. So the nicest stuff I got to drive was my parents' cars, and they were no fun. You know, it was a Tempo. But now if I saw one, I'd be like, oh my God, a 93 Tempo GLS. Oh, I haven't seen one of these in years.
Yeah. Oh, we had a Tempo in my family.
Yeah.
We had a Oldsmobile. I want to say it was in the 70s, I think it was. I'm trying to remember exactly when my dad bought it. And it was mint green with a white top and white leather interior.
That sounds like a late 70s Cutlass
Supreme. Right?
That's right.
Colonnade. And Supreme, an Omega. Well, I guess that was 80s.
No, I think it was in the 70s. I remember crying when he bought that car. Like physically, actually crying. Yeah. I don't think it had anything to do with the fact that I was really tired. But I remember crying in the backseat. And then don't you know that was like my car in, you know, when I turned 16, that I then had to drive to high school, you know, with the really cool Wilton lacrosse team players that my brother was on, you know, all watching David's little sister arrive in my mint green awful Oldsmobile.
We had a green 73 Dodge Dart Sport.
Oh. But at least it was sport.
Well, there was nothing sporty about sport.
In 1973, when they were trying to figure out what to do, they had to throw things like sport on the name. Now, to be fair, I know it sounded like I was making fun of the 50s style car show, but for a long time, the people taking the cars to the car show, they were living somewhat of a similar experience as what we are experiencing going to Radwood. You know, it was just, you know, the people who did remember the vehicles from the 50s and the 57 Chevys and all of that. It's just that for so long, that seemed to define what a car show was. And it is neat to see that, yes, those are still existing and they serve an important purpose, but there are more opportunities and more experiences for people to like different types of cars.
Well, I think, too, it comes back to the fact that, like, they were meant to be driven, and it's a shame to see them parked on the lawn. I like to see them out and about. That's what makes vintage racing so cool. You get to see these things getting, you know, used, like, 100%. And, you know, I mean, from your perspective, like, look, put insurance policy on it. It's just a car. Like, that's go right. Enjoy it.
Exactly. You know? They're meant to be driven. Cars are happiest when they're driven. Yes, once in a while, unfortunate things happen, but that's okay. You know, there's that's That's why the insurance side of Hagerty exists, you know, but we'd rather see them all be driven.
Well, and one of the interesting things about Hagerty that I learned from you is about, you know, sometimes when unfortunate things happen to those cars, they end up in Hagerty's possession, like that 61 Fury, and then they get restored. You know, I mean, tell us about that.
You know, wait. Are you just like harvesting cars?
No. it would be easy to think that, but
it'd be a shame if something happened to it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. This one has serial number one. No. What Sam is referring to is we have, this has been going on for close to a decade now, what we call an employee restoration program. So there's always at least one restoration taking place at our garage in Traverse City, as well as we've got an office with about 300 employees in Golden, Colorado, and there's a garage there as well, that any employee, if they want to during their working day, can sign up and go take part in this restoration. So we do have skilled, trained restoration technicians that mentor and shepherd this process. But the whole idea is, you know, we have an awful lot of employees that come in and they don't have a car background. But every person that they're interacting with, whether it's on the phone or over email, this is a part of that person's life. And so this is our way of introducing them into what it takes to restore and properly maintain these cars. And so, to what Sam was referring to, over the years, there have been times that we have purchased a totaled vehicle because we use it as a training exercise. And so I give you two examples. One of them was a 69 Camaro RS with the, SS with the 396 in it. It was 4-speed, it's a beautiful car, orange with a black vinyl top, and it's kind of a sad story. The owner was taking it out for its first drive in the springtime, and you know, it's got that gauge cluster in front of the shifter in the center console. Yeah. You know, there's four gauges down there, and he was staring at the gauges to make sure everything was okay, and was in a pretty significant accident, ran into the back of something else. Fortunately, this person was okay, but it totaled the car. You know, what totals a vehicle is, it's from an insurance standpoint, and this is true across the board, is the cost it is to repair it relative to the vehicle's value. So if there's ever any plug out there from an insurance standpoint in your collector card, do not ever underinsure, because if it comes time to it being totaled, it's all based on what it's going to cost relative to the car's value. But if this Camaro was a several hundred thousand dollar or multi-million dollar vehicle with the same level of damage, you'd fix it, because even if it cost $500,000 or more to fix it, if it's a multi-million dollar vehicle, it makes sense. And so we brought it in to use it as a training exercise specifically for the folks in our claims team of what it takes to repair a badly damaged car. And typically what happens in a vehicle that is approaching half a century old is, at the time when we restored it, is it was also had been somewhat of an accident at another time in its life from the rear end. Poorly repaired.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was nothing, you know, this is the type of car that if you drove it straight down the road, it would leave four tracks, you know? So we had to fix all, but those are real world situations that people in the collector car space face. And so that's a good learning exercise for us. And so the theory that Sam referenced, this is a sad story from the other extreme, is a wonderfully restored car, someone's pride and joy. And the house it lived in was a coastal home in New Jersey. And Superstorm Sandy, or Hurricane Sandy, which is what, 5-6 years ago now, or more, it was
more
flooded
than that,
up.
Yeah,
more than that.
8 years ago.
Yeah, it was flooded up above the door handles in salt water, you know, because it was, you know, quite with the flood surge. And so When you, if someone asks the question, what does it take to restore a vehicle that's been submerged in salt water? And the answer is you've got to take it down to the bare body shell, and which we did, and put it on a rotisserie and sent it down to a company in Detroit, and they dipped it, you know, put it in a chemical bath that neutralized, you know, every little speck of where salt could have been. And then we rebuilt it from there. And again, it was a training exercise. So no, we're not in the business of harvesting someone's fortune, but once a year, you know, seeing what does happen, and, you know, we're talking several thousand examples. We do use it as a learning exercise, because again, especially our claims team, they're interacting with people that are dealing with these types of situations all day long.
Well, I think for the claims folks too, is and the adjusters, they have to have a good idea of what they're looking at, which that's got to be a little different with the sort of varied nature of older cars as well, or you know, the sort of collector vintage car market.
It is, and it can get complicated, especially when it comes to sourcing replacement parts. Depending on the vehicle, common vehicles, parts are readily available. Rare vehicles, it can become a challenge. And of course, you hope to find either a really good original example of whatever component you need, or when it needs to happen, you pay to have the piece fabricated. And the good news is that can happen. I mean, literally anything can be made.
Do you have an example of like something unobtainium that you managed to get made?
Well, 3D printing technology has really, really opened up a lot of avenues for that. So, I mean, when it comes to body panels, a skilled metal shaper can make any body panel. So you just have to know who the good ones are. But, you know, 10 years ago, before 3D printing really started to become more prevalent like it is now, what became difficult was various trim pieces, especially if it was interior components, you know, Bakelite or early plastics.
Yeah.
On rare cars.
Radio, you know, knobs and climate control.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, if a car had suffered minor fire damage, for example, and you had to source all of these little detailed interior parts, that really could become troublesome. And now a lot of that stuff can, either the part itself can be 3D printed, or you 3D print the part to then make the casting for whatever that part is. So, you know, an example, here's one that comes to mind. There was a client of ours that had a Lincoln Zephyr. Gosh, it was a 41, just before they shut down. It might have actually even been a 42 model, but I could be wrong. But anyways, it was one of the last before they shut down for the wartime production of World War II. And it had this very intricate emblem on the side, both sides of the hood, that it either said Lincoln or Zephyr, maybe it even said both. But again, it was not available. There was not enough of these cars. There's not any companies making them aftermarket. And this was it was custom made at a machine shop. You know, you just, with CAD drawings and the machinery that's there, it really is, it's opened up a lot of areas that even a decade ago were more challenging. Now, what's going to be interesting, if we look out 25, 30, 40 years from now, looking at today's cars with how sophisticated they are from a technology standpoint, is not so much the hardware, but the software programming that it takes to run today's cars. If someone doesn't keep it or doesn't release that programming, that'll become a challenge.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's like, who knows COBOL, right? Yeah. When they had to update, Well, think about all the government systems when everyone started to apply for unemployment. Yeah. Those systems were so outdated. They were literally pulling in people from retirement that new COBOL.
COBOL and Fortran. You know, yeah, all that stuff.
Or Fortran, right.
You know, McLaren's a great example. You know, the F1, they only built 106 of those.
Wow.
And, you know, it had electronic engine controls. You know, it was a relatively early example of that and had some pretty sophisticated electronics for the time.
Yes.
And, you know, McLaren has to keep a stock of old, you know, 1990s era compact laptops on hand just so they can run the software to interface with this thing when the cars have to come in for service. Yeah.
I didn't know if they had to like also keep the programmers, you know, old decrepit programmers as well.
That's right. But it really is. And I don't know. And maybe there are people out there that are thinking long-term, but I'm not aware of it yet. But yeah, at some point people are going to be seeking out different software programming that, and especially if it was for a more mass produced vehicle, I mean, these automakers spent millions of dollars developing. So for a person to recreate on their own, that'll be a challenge.
You're right, because it's circuit boards and then understanding. I mean, it's supposed to be the hardware and the software, right? It's recreating the hardware where it's needed and then reprogramming the software. And yes, you're absolutely right. That's just something that you don't have to do in a 1990s kind of car or anything else like that.
Yes.
I'm sorry if you can hear my cat. She loves it.
I'm used to that. If you know, if you look in the background, you can see a little gray. So she usually comes, you know, if I'm on a Zoom call about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, she usually comes in to yell at me. So
yes, exactly.
So, you know, another area that Hagerty's expanded into, you know, in the last decade is content production. You know, the automotive journalism business has been a tough one over the last several years, you know, lot of great writers have lost their jobs, you know, at some of the old Buff books, and a lot of them have ended up working for Hagerty. You know, talk about that.
Yeah, it's so, you know, what is now the Hagerty Drivers Club magazine, and the subscription, as far as the number of people who receive each issue in their mailbox, about 650,000. And then, of course, we've got the digital side of it. But, you know, this started, I've been at Hagerty for 13 years, and so a little bit before that. So about 15 years ago, it literally was a quarterly newsletter that went out to people who paid for it. Wasn't just insurance clients, but people who had what at the time was called Hagerty Plus, which was essentially a roadside assistance program in addition to the Hagerty to their insurance policy. And that newsletter grew into for a while what was a quarterly magazine, and we've increased the number of issues a year and also other publications. We produce what's called the Hagerty Insider, and that's all very focused on the market side of the industry. And what has been an awful lot of it's been fun, it's been educational for us, but what is different about the model, how we have grown this, is so those 650,000 people that receive that magazine each issue at their home, we know exactly what is in their garage. And we know exactly, I mean, there's no generalized readership surveys. There's no, you know, like that. It's just, so that is what has been unique about Hagerty's content efforts within the automotive space. And it's just, and we're going to continue to grow it. We see a lot of opportunity there, but that being said, you know, we recognize it's been a challenging time for the larger media industry, and we don't want to be the only ones. You know, we think it's healthy and vibrant for multiple publications to still exist.
Well, I think really the best way for other publications to exist is you just got to help them. You got to tell us where the money is so we can go get it. So we can pay the writers.
No, but it is cool to see how Hagerty, especially in the last few years, it seems, has really evolved and almost modernized and stayed so relevant. I mean, I feel like in the last just even 3 years, really 4 years, that it's that you guys have really expanded into all the right places, into places that people need advice, need insights, need guidance. And it's been really exciting to see, because it's a name that I think a lot of us have always known in the industry, but it was also, oh, if I don't have a CASA car, I don't need Hagerty services. But now it seems like really there's so much more that you guys do. How many people actually work for Hagerty? Because you threw out that 300 person number in Golden. Was that part of RPM or is that separate?
No, so globally, we're just shy of 1,500 employees.
Wow, so I did not realize it was that large.
Yeah, about 900 in Michigan, between Traverse City and Ann Arbor. We have an office of about 300 employees in Golden, Colorado. We have a relatively new office in Dublin, Ohio, and an office in north of Toronto, an office north of London in the UK, and then a small team in Germany. And so 1,500 people. And then there's a handful of people in home-based offices throughout North America.
Right.
In specific territories. And of course, now we find ourselves in this current state where everyone's kind of proved to the world that you can work remotely. So that footprint's probably going to change. Won't just be limited to where we have actual physical real estate. But to your point earlier, Rebecca, when I first joined the company, it was a very conscious decision that was on the table, because Hagerty's business, it's got its start in insurance, being this niche insurance industry filling a need that wasn't there at the time. And the company was at the point where there was kind of this decision, do you explore other avenues in the insurance space? Mm-hmm. So get into daily transportation vehicles, get into homeowners, get into other areas, or in the decision, and I'm very thankful for it, was no, we're going to stay intensely focused in the enthusiast space. And every decision is going to be focused around helping people get the most enjoyment out of cars that they choose to want to have fun with. And so it was that type of mindset that lended itself to what is now the Hagerty Price Guide, or the Hagerty Valuation Tools Online, to grow the magazine, to do a lot of the other stuff that Hagerty's done. It's all been around the enthusiast space, and there's many, many companies that are focused in the standard insurance market, and they're good at what they do. That's not our interest.
Right. That's so cool. I love that. Yeah.
So no, it's just been, I mean, for a car nut like me, I went to school to restore cars, and that's my, that's my hobby. Is, I love tinkering in the garage in the evenings and weekends, but this is it's been a great company to be with.
That's awesome. Yeah. All right, well,
I have one or two more questions,
okay,
though. So I do understand that you've bought a rather interesting house that was owned by a woman that liked red cars.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the remnants of the wall of plaques?
Oh my, yes.
I dug deep, big guy.
Yes, you did. That's impressive.
These journalists got you questions.
That is impressive. I would love to hear the path they got to that. No,
we can't disclose their sources.
We can't disclose their sources, but it was one text message.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, so no, this will explain some of the problems that run around my head. So it'll be 2 years in November, purchased a house that I moved into, and the property, the house was built in 91, but what motivated this purchase was it has a pole barn, and a 30 by 40 pole barn, which at the time I thought, oh, this will be perfect. It's all I'll ever need.
I'll never fill that up.
Well, I'll tell you what, I wish it was bigger. Yeah. It goes into it. But,
we're building another one.
Yeah, but, of course, when I was touring, the house was, it was very well cared for, but it was outdated. It was as it was built in 91. And like I like to tell people, picture your grandmother building a house in 91, and that's what it looks like. And but when I was in the basement taking a tour, there's just a small part of the basement is somewhat finished with drywall. And I have never seen more nails in a wall and nail holes. And I'm like, what in the world did they have down here? But, you know, whatever, didn't think anything of it. Well, I didn't find out until well after the fact that purchased the house and spent 6 months doing cosmetic remodeling, all stuff just to get a pole barn that's too small now. But but I ended up meeting the son of the elderly couple that I had purchased it from, and he's a car guy. But yeah, it was his mother more so than his father. They had 12 red Fords.
Oh my God. At once or like in succession?
No, all at once. All at once. And all of the nails and the nail holes in that room in the basement was, and they, every weekend in the summer months, they were going to some type of car show, some type of cruising or whatever. And, you know, they were in it for the trophies and the plaques. And,
wow.
And so that's what all those nails were. It was every plaque, every trophy, every, for all of those 12 cars. And I have since been to, so the son, he purchased the majority of the vehicles from his parents. And so this collection of red Fords still exists. And it's an interesting variety. I mean, it's a first generation Mustang, a handful of Thunderbirds, a Galaxy to you know a 95 Thunderbird Super Coupe, you know, supercharged, you know,
yeah,
whatever year the Mach 1 Mustang was in the early 2000s, 03, 04, something.
Yeah,
03. Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so all red, you know, and but anyways, he and his parents are still alive. They're quite elderly and assisted living, but he, as a tribute to them, he organized all of those plaques and all those trophies and hung them in his storage building. And I saw, and I'm like,
wow,
I didn't know there's this many plaques could exist. Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool.
No. So anyways, yeah. So this place has a legacy of fun old cars.
That's awesome.
Mine are not all the same color though. I can tell you that.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, no, this is fun. This is fun.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Jonathan. This has been great.
Absolutely. No, I'd love to come back. There's all sorts of fun topics the four of us could talk about.
Absolutely. Excellent. We'll definitely have you back.
All right,
that would be great.
Good. All right. We'll see you all next time. Hopefully we'll see you in person here at some point too.
Yeah, right? Hopefully.
Well, so that about does it for episode 166 of Wheel Bearings. You know where to find us, so keep the feedback coming and we'll see everybody next time.
Bye.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.